listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
On this, in 1967, over 400 million people, the Beatles, Our World, it was live international satellite television. Intel Stat 1, early, Intel Stat 2, ATS 1 satellites. The event featured creative artists representing 19 different nations. To close the broadcast, people sang a new song specially composed for the occasion. Love, love, love. Love, love, love. Love, love. There's nothing you can do that can't be done. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say, but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. Nothing you can make that can't be made. No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time. It's easy. All you need is love. A bum-ba-da-da-da. All you need is love. A bum-ba-da-da-da. All you need is love, love. Love is all you need. Love, love, love. Love, love, love. Love, love, love. And nothing you can know that isn't known. Nothing you can see that isn't shown. Nowhere you can be that isn't where you're meant to be. It's easy. All you need is love. All you need is love. All you need is love, love. Love is all you need. All you need is love. Love is all you need. Love is all you need. Love is all you need. John Lennon said that those were the most important five words he had ever written. Well, I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream Radio Show. And like John Lennon, we strongly believe in the importance of love. That's why we keep on streaming this radio show week after week. Every week since February 3, 2011, we just two or three skipped. It's about 225, 226, something like that. That's how many shows there have been so far. Well, we plan to keep going for another 225 or more. We believe there can be a better America, a better world, where people share love rather than hate. They make peace rather than war. And they help each other to grow rather than cutting each other down. So we tell you about the things that are wrong around us and we make fun of them. And we talk about how we can change the world. But the way to create big changes in the world is to make small changes in our own lives and in those of the people around us. We ask you all, help each other, love each other, teach each other. And I'm very proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. We welcome tonight's special guests, Julius Alafong, Kieran Kitkowski, and Michael Hannes. And so tonight we are joining together for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Denver, Cameroon, Mount Jackson, and wherever you are. Some things I just want to make note of, something the recommendations on the internet. If you go to Memory Hole blog, you'll find a discussion of the Charleston shooting, suggesting that it was a hoax, a false flag. Vincent Bugliosi has died. He prosecuted Manson. He wrote the massive book claiming Oswald killed JFK. And in light of all we have learned in the past 15 or so years, is it conceivable to imagine that Bugliosi and Manson were government ops? Didn't the Manson family murders kill the 1960s revolution? Just saying. And here's something at Black Op Radio. If you'll go to the Black Op Radio website, go to the archives, you will find a recent interview with Scott Enyart, E-N-Y-A-R-T. Scott Enyart was a photographer in the pantry the night that Robert F. Kennedy was shot. And he had his, he took a bunch of photos, but his photos got taken by the FBI and never returned. Also, I want to recommend a Democracy Now! Interview with Jill Stein as she announces her Green Party run for president. Also want to recommend on Veterans Today, Gordon Duff, as he takes apart the so-called manifesto by the so-called Charleston shooter, Dylan Roof. Want to recommend No Lies Radio, the Kevin Barrett Show with guest Rabbi Michael Lerner. The Pope's environmental encyclical can save the world. Also, try Googling Dick Gregory speaks on the Charleston shooting. That's it. Okay, back to you, Chuck.
Please join us now for another episode of Fred the Farmer. Fred the Farmer sits like Eeyore out in his pasture on the edge of his field watching the dirt. Fred used to watch those cartoons with his kids, and he recalls how Eeyore was able to make the clouds pretty colors with just his thoughts, and how Eeyore liked to sit out on the hillside being alone. Cloud painting, he called it. Fred tries to make the corn grow by thinking about it just once for a second. He wished he could be out working. Not working is boring. But it's been raining so much. Then it was too windy to haul rocks that one day. He could be in the house watching Biggest Hamburger and Cleanest Kitchen, but, well, he was for a while, but he just had to come out here. He feels like somebody out here. Like this is his spot in the world. Everybody should have a spot, somewhere to be. Even him, right? He could plow and cultivate and pick year-round. He'd never be sad. And then, Fred the Farmer got a thought that made his legs stand up. He thought, well, Fred got up and walked to the dirt and squatted to pick up a dirt clod. He crumbled it. The mud just squished in his fingers. He could plant in this, he thought. But that would be crazy. Planting in mud? He'd get laughed at. Fred looked up at the chemtrails marking the sky like apple pie crusts. Fred turned around and ran to the barn. He got everything ready. He nuzzled the nose of the tractor up to the field. Light, fluffy snow covered the windshield. Fred got out to stand next to his tractor. The sky was almost white now from chemtrail. In a minute, he began to sweat. He took off his cap. Oh, bother. It rained for just a moment. Then for a minute, it was so cold, he shivered. Then it was hot again. So hot, he climbed into the cab and turned on the air conditioning. As he sat there, a flood came to the top of the tractor tires and then subsided as he listened to sports talk on the cab radio. A tornado whipped by, carrying one of Fred's horses, just before a hurricane named Steve roared past. Hail clattered on the windshield, then the sun came out to melt. Fred bowed his head, folded his hands in his lap, and took a deep breath. God, Fred would. Buddha, thanks for noticing me. But Zeus, Homeland Security, NSA, he raised his voice a little for just a moment. Alan the alien, please stop effing with me. Please Join us next time for another episode of Fred the Farmer, where we will see Fred watching his daughter's video of Born Free while reading Animal Farm and deciding to let all his livestock loose and having his wife get pretty mad to have to drive into town and zigzag around the cows and pigs and chickens just standing there. And now, please join us for another exciting episode of Tina Thompson, Taco Bell trainee. Tina began her training a week ago. Tony, the manager, requires each new trainee to spend one shift at each of the workstations. Counter, ice cream, table cleaning, parking lot patrol, salads, burgers, fries. The final test is one day on the drive-thru window. Tony has a deal with the local movie theater, so the drive-thru people have to incorporate a blurb about the latest movies into their greeting. Good afternoon. Now showing Red Dawn. America is saved from terrorists by a group of gutsy red, white, and blue teenagers in a small Midwestern town. Black 030. Follow a group of brave Navy SEALs in their amazing mission to kill Osama bin Laden. How may I help you? And then the person orders a number one or number five, and the drive-thru person asks if they'd like to supersize that, and they have a coupon in their chubby little fist for one night of the Kill 'em All video game that they can check out right now by adding just 99 cents to their order with the coupon. Tina came on at noon, and well, by 2 o'clock, she'd already decided. She took a break, went to the restroom, put in her tongue ring, ruffled her hair, returned to her window. Have you heard about the recent Walmart strike? She asked the first car. When they said no, she asked him if they really believe Osama bin Laden had been buried at sea. No, he died 12 years ago, the driver said. That whole thing's a lie for political purposes. Just like Jessica Lynch, WMD, Pat Tillman. The driver's squawky answer echoed out loud into the Taco Bell. Tina yelled, yeah, raised a clenched fist and turned inside to the people at the counter. Two old ladies and a young man held up their fists for a moment just before ordering the number two. Like fired up beyond belief, Tina turned and addressed her next customer sitting in the blue Camry where the drive-through lane snaked around the store and out back by the dumpster. 9/11 was an inside job. They killed Wellstone, Tina told the person. She talked about Iraq, the drug wars, and prisons. And people in the line began leaving their vehicles and walking up to the squawk order board window thing instead of waiting so they could hear what Tina was talking about. And little kids from the neighborhood stopped throwing rocks at cats to wander over and sit in the bushes and listen to the squawk box girl. And when a group of men in a pickup wearing orange caps and orange mittens pulled up to her window, Tina told them everything she thought about hunters and hunting. They yelled, flipped her off, squealed the tires, and Tina turned to see Tony, the manager, standing there. He pointed to the note cards in the window and asked why she wasn't using them. I didn't want to, she said. Tony nodded, turned, walked away. The next morning, when Tina arrived for her scheduled shift, the first day of being regular full-time, she didn't know if she still had a job. She stomped her feet on the rug, hung up her coat and back, and saw her photo on the bulletin board with assistant manager underneath. Tina found Tony and asked him what was up with that. You got guts, kid. And you make us better. You complete us. Here, Tony handed Tina a box of magnetic letters, and the latter said her first assignment as assistant manager was to go out and change the sign out front. Tina went and finished the job, backed down the ladder, stepped back a ways to see her work. She put her hands on her hips and smiled as she read, over 100,000 tacos served, 99 cents for two soft shells, and not freaking stupid anymore.
Join us next week for another episode when we will hear Tina recommend the Oswald is Innocent Chalupas and the 9/11 Truth Gordita with medium Pepsi for only $2.39. Our first guest of the night is Julius Holofong. Julius Holofong comes to us each month from Cameroon, and Chuck will be getting him on the line right about now.
Chuck and Mike, thank you. This time around, we'll be talking about how we could understand the crisis of the present-day African state. I will use two schools of thought, that is, the dependent school of thought and the school of thought of the historicity of the state, how they perceive or how they x-ray the present-day situation of the African state. Let's start with the dependent school of thought. This school of thought is largely influenced by the Marxist ideology and propounded by authors like Sami Ramin, Frantz Fanon, Ounangini, and some other authors. And it considers the African state to be a product of capitalist domination, an instrument of neocolonialism. This school of thought considers the state in Africa as a state that depends not only on other states, notably the Western state, but as a state that equally depends on foreign multinational firms, that depends on international organizations, and that equally depends on international financial institutions. From this perspective, political, economic, and cultural independence of the post-colonial African state is in all its form deprived of its entire consistence. This dependency nowadays is concretized through Françafrique, the Commonwealth, the structural adjustment policies from the Bretton Woods institution imposed on African state. We could have the democratic conditions for economic aid. We have the interference into African affairs, especially the electoral problems in Africa. We have a disregard of the sovereignty of the African state. We have the fueling of conflict in Africa, like in the Ivory Coast, in Libya, and in the Central African Republic, in Darfur, in Sudan. And even though the school of thought, or this dependent school of thought, is founded, it equally has a main shortcoming, which is that it ignores the freedom that African political figures have in their possession, in their relation with the outside world, in order to turn things around. This is a view held by the other school of thought called the school of thought of the historicity of the state. This school of thought, that is the school of thought of the historicity of the state, considers that despite the heavy hands of the West, African actors possess margins of freedom and the liberty which permits them to reinvent the state in Africa by conferring on the state directions that will be completely different from those initiated by the colonial masters. The present-day Africa, which could be described as being highly influenced by Europe and the West, in general could be traced as far back as the 15th century. During this period, the world economy was based on mercantilism, where the Spaniards and the Portuguese explorers decided to tour the world in search of gold and precious metals, which was considered as a source of wealth. Spain and Portugal were considered as centers of the world during this period, and areas that were in possession of gold and precious metals were the Latin America, Africa, and Asia. So the fate of Africa started when, on their way to Asia, these 15th century Europeans found themselves in Latin America, where they saw abundant gold and precious metals. And after exploiting and exporting them to Europe, they decided to colonize the Red Indies. The only equipment available at that time was the human force. So they started meeting out hard labor on the Red Indies or on the Amerindians, another name for the Red Indies. These Red Indians could not sustain violent and high physical labor force imposed on them by these Europeans, so they started committing suicide. Some died in their numbers from torture. When His Lordship Las Casas saw the massive disappearance of the Amerindians caused by the European enterprises, He advised Europeans not to continue maltreating Amerindians, the Amerindian populace, because God is not happy, and advised them to go and get labor force from Africa, because Africans were, first of all, very robust. The advantage is that they were economically more productive. And secondly, on the psychology plan, there were people who did not react when you hit them. Suddenly, there was an enterprise put in place to conquer the African coast. Queen Elizabeth I of England is even mentioned as being the main sponsor, or the person who financed the construction of the first Negro slave ship. This ship, baptized Jesus, was the first slave ship to cross the African coast to loot black Africans who were to be used as slaves. But these Europeans could not have captured black Africans without the complicity of other Africans themselves, in particular the coastal chiefs. But these Europeans also used tricks they offered coastal chiefs adulterated wine, a wine that did not only get them quickly drunk, but a wine which was mixed with soap, which took them to the toilet almost every minute. With this, African chiefs did not have the time to negotiate properly. For those chiefs who did not want their children to be taken over, saw themselves being threatened, and their wives and children would be kidnapped and reduced to slaves if they did not cooperate. So, during this first encounter between Africa, Europe, and America, Africa was the great loser, because Africa lost its valid populace, since those who were kidnapped were strong, robust, and energetic, and this saw the African economy for the first time being stagnated. It was stagnated because those who remained behind, who could cultivated products like coffee, cocoa, which they did not consume, and which were destined primarily for the European market or the European industries. Africa lost through the decimation of its fauna. This is because when Europeans came to Africa for slaves, they discovered elephants and started killing them for the commercialization of ivory. Africa also lost on the cultural domain, because there was the degradation of morals due to the expansion of violence. When Africans were captured, they, that is the women, the men, and the children, were stripped naked in public, and their genital organs were touched to see if they were normal. Those who wanted to resist were beaten and some died. This was a form of violence that Africans saw for the first time. Another moral violence was that when some of these Europeans got drunk as a means to respond to their sexual desires, they raped an African minor. This was a scandal for Africans, because sex to them was mainly for procreation. It is important to highlight that slave trade existed in Africa before the advent of the Europeans, and this was mostly practiced by Muslims from the Middle East and the other parts of the world. Muslims were the first who started the Negro slave trade, and it was called the Eastern Slave Trade. It traded the route through Mozambique, North Tanzania, and through the former Zaire, or the Democratic Republic of Congo. Africans who were captured by these Muslims underwent a selection, wherefrom some were chosen and sent to cater for the harems of the Muslim leaders. Before being taken to cater for the harems, most of them, or all of them, were castrated. You know, Muslim leaders usually keep so many wives that they are unable to satisfy sexually. And there are times when most of these wives become emotionally disturbed due to sex deprivation. So these black Negroes were used to satisfy them, and castration was therefore necessary in order not to allow them impregnate any of these women. So with so much wealth amassed by some Europeans, capitalist expansion led to the Industrial Revolution. Industrial Revolution saw the transition from commercial capitalism to industrial capitalism. those who enrich themselves through slave trade and accumulation of gold and precious metals gave a new orientation for massive accumulation. This was called the Industrial Revolution. And the center of the world moved from Spain and Portugal to England, where the Industrial Revolution was born. The Industrial Revolution introduced a new system of mechanized production founded on abundance of capital, availability of technical production, and a new organization model of work. Production was based on industry, and it was truly a revolution because industry started producing 10, 20, or 30 more times of riches than in the past. Africa again comes in here, I mean, during the Industrial Revolution as a great loser, even though it satisfied in an abundant manner European industries. And the surpluses produced by these European industries needed to be evacuated to other parts of the world, and colonization therefore facilitated the process of evacuation of the sale and the sales of these surpluses to Africa. African territories started being a dump ground. This led Europeans to accumulate more and more of capital. But it is important to understand how strategically these European states succeeded in imposing the sales of their surpluses on Africa. They used three tools or three techniques, which were the International Division of Labor, the Colonial Pact, and the Unequal Exchange. Let's start with the International Division of Labor. By the International Division of Labor, it meant that Africa had to produce and supply raw materials used for the growth and the maintenance of European industries. For example, Africa cultivated palm nuts, rubber, cocoa, coffee, and many other items destined for the European market, even though these items meant nothing for the African market. But this International Division of Labor was guided by what was called the Colonial Pact. What is the Colonial Pact? The Colonial Pact meant that colonies or colonized African territories could only export their raw materials to their colonial powers. For example, Nigeria, a former British colony or colonial territory, could sell its raw material only to Britain. The other way around, Senegal, a French colony, could buy a German good only through France, its colonial master. That is, France had to buy from Germany before reselling to Senegal. So Colonial Pact therefore prevented colonies from selling to the highest bidder. They could not also buy at a cheaper rate directly from the source. This Colonial Pact led to what we call unequal
Now, please join us for another episode of The American on the Hot Sidewalk, holding up a tin can and a sign in the middle of the city. The American on the Hot Sidewalk, holding up a tin can and a sign in the middle of the city, looked up and squinted at somebody staring down at him. Holding up his can in one hand and his sign in another, he tries to make his signs humorous, something about how his family was kidnapped by ninjas and now he needs money for karate lessons. But today's sign says, "The poor go to prison, the rich go to hell." And this person isn't smiling. The American on the hot sidewalk holding up a tin can and a sign in the middle of the city looked away from the not smiling person in the sun and rested his head back against the brick wall yet again. He closed his eyes and went to his happy place. Sometimes that was the Dairy Queen in Ocala. Sometimes it was riding a horse with his father near Cumberland. Sometimes it was other things. He went there, he came back. He squinted his eyes against the sun to see if he was still being watched. The American on the hot sidewalk, holding up a can and a sign in the middle of the city, held up his sign to block the sun, kept reading the book he held on the back side of the sign. And in the eyes of the people, there is the failure. And in the eyes of the hungry, there is a growing wrath. In the souls of the people, the grapes of wrath are filling and growing heavy for the vintage. One man, one family, driven from the land, this rusty car creaking along the highway to the west, I lost my land. A single tractor took my land. I am alone and bewildered. And in the night, one family camps in a ditch, and another family pulls in, and the tents come out. The two men squat on their hams, and the women and children listen. Here is the node. You who hate change and fear revolution, keep these two squatting men apart. Make them hate, fear, suspect each other. Here is the analyze of the thing you fear. This is the zygote. For here, I lost my land, is changed. A cell is split, and from its splitting grows the thing you hate. We lost our land. The danger is here, for two men are not as lonely and perplexed as one. And from this first we, there grows a still more dangerous thing. I have a little food, plus I have none. If from this problem the sum is we have a little food, the thing is on its way. The movement has direction. Only a little multiplication now in this land, this tractor, are ours. The two men squatting in a ditch, the little fire, the side meat stewing in a single pot, the silent, stone-eyed women behind, the children listening with their souls to words their minds do not understand. The night draws down. The baby has a cold. Here, take this blanket. It's wool. It was my mother's blanket. Take it for the baby. This is the thing to bomb. This is the beginning from I to we. And the great owners who must lose their land in an upheaval, the great owners with access to history, with eyes to read history and to know the great fact, when property accumulates in too few hands, it is taken away. And that companion fact, when a majority of the people are hungry and cold, they will take by force what they need. And the little screaming fact that sounds through all history, repression works only to strengthen and knit the repressed. The great owners ignored the three cries of history. The land fell into fewer hands. The number of the dispossessed increased, and every effort of the great owners was directed at repression. The money was spent for arms, for gas to protect the great holdings, and spies were sent to catch the murmuring of revolt so that it might be stamped out. The changing economy was ignored, plans for the change ignored, and only means to destroy revolt were considered, while the causes of revolt went on. And this message brought to you by the Foundation for a New American Dream. Did we go to the moon? Maybe, maybe not. But just like Voldemort in so many discussions that are prohibited in America, it is one that cannot be named. Was 9/11 an inside job? Stop. See, like that. You can't talk about that. Was Paul Wellstone assassinated? A roll of the eyes. You are sent to Siberia by your brother, your mother, and your cousin. Disapparated from the Thanksgiving dinner table. Poof. No one can now see you or talk to you. You are a non-person. Might as well go smoke in the garage. Did FDR provoke Pearl Harbor in order to get into World War II? Did the government burn men, women, and children alive at Waco? Was the government involved in the Oklahoma City bombing? Are so-called terror plots and mass murders, such as in Aurora, Colorado, and now Charleston, and dozens of other terrorist events, actually engineered by the FBI and CIA, NSA, in order to bring about a zeitgeist of fear and scare Americans into accepting a police state? What are chemtrails? What does the government know about UFOs? Why does Sirhan not remember anything about the RFK shooting? Who shot Martin Luther King? James Earl Ray said he didn't do it. Evidence says the FBI and others did it. Do those questions have merit or are they preposterous? We will never know because Brian Williams and NBC and Amy Goodman and NPR are afraid of even the question. Why? 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 Did Bush steal the elections of 2000 and 2004? Ask these questions on any mainstream or so-called liberal website or TV show or newspaper or radio show, and you will get laughed down. Ask it on the so-called liberal progressive Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart. They will try to humiliate you. Why? Is it because you are truly so hilariously pathetic? Or is it because they are so, so afraid? The foundation for a new American dream, because it's time to wake up. Your toast is ready. The bus is here. The world is on fire. Nominations are currently being accepted to rename all the places we have named for horrible people. Ronald Reagan National Airport, the 10th Mountain Division Highway, the 90th Infantry Division Highway, 173rd Airborne Brigade Memorial Highway, Gerald Ford Memorial Highway, George Bush Intercontinental Airport, If we're going to name things after famous bad people, then why not? Well, how about Ted Bundy National Cemetery, John Wayne Gacy International Airport, or Jeffrey Dahmer Memorial Freeway, the Charles Manson Space Needle? Rather, here's a thought. Why not name things for good people rather than terrible people? Why not Dan and Phil Berrigan International Airport, Dorothy Day Interstate, the Emma Goldman Freeway? Brought to you by Citizens for naming things after good people rather than horrible people.
And this from your local public library. There's one Tooth Fairy, one Santa, and one Easter Bunny. And there are 900 second-in-command of something called Al-Qaeda. And we kill them every day that we need to cover up something else we're doing. This message brought to you by your American Myth System. We're also sponsored tonight by Greatest Generation Beer, brewed from the finest something-something. Look for the long-haired hippie on the red, white, and blue can, because it's not about killing just because somebody tells you to and not being smart enough to think for yourself. It's all about the courage to fight for what is really right. Greatest Generation Beer. It's actually great. And now for our ninth grade, first period civics moment.
Please follow along as I read from page one of our textbook, Democracy in America. To change things, because we are a free and open society, unlike so many others, write your congressman, vote, or if you really want to go out on the ledge, march in a large, peaceful protest. If you don't participate, you have no right to complain.
But because you may someday realize these things are useless, you'll have to find some extracurricular way to ever actually participate in the running of this country. And let's just say that perhaps by some extraordinary happenstance of money or talent or circumstance, you might actually find you have a voice. That's where your biggest decision will be made. Either shut up and live the good American life, or persist in your selfish pursuits.
And if you become powerful enough to actually change things and continue to persist in your childish notion of democracy, someone will shoot you between the eyes or in the back of the head, and we will speak no more about you.
Now please stand quietly next to your desks for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Hello, this is Jimmy Breslin taking over for Andy Rooney. We are televising the revolution. We have taken over the airways. We have dumped the tea into the harbor, stormed the Bastille. We are eating jelly donuts without a napkin in the West Room. We are crapping in the Rose Garden and telling fart jokes from the microphone at the front railing of the House of Representatives. Mount Rushmore has fresh egg on its faces, and the Pentagon has been ransacked by welfare moms and rednecks, redecorated and turned into a free daycare center for Northwest D.C. families. Outside the CIA building and the J. Edgar Hoover FBI headquarters building, the sidewalks are littered with broken chairs, busted desks, and dented badges. The overhead highway copter cam shows George Bush Sr. being shoved into the backseat of a sheriff's car outside the Midland Country Club. There is a low-speed chase taking place outside Dallas with George W. Bush in the backseat of a white Bronco, threatening to hold his breath. The Obama family is attempting to take off by helicopter from the White House lawn, but there are 50 people hanging onto the landing skids, and the copter cannot take off. Hillary and Bill Clinton have been captured in clown disguise, sitting in the Dairy Queen on 2nd Street in Little Rock. Karl Rove is in protective custody in the D.C. City Jail. Dick Cheney is, as we speak, being tarred and feathered by the citizens of Laramie, Wyoming, and Condoleezza Rice is just now being arraigned for conspiracy and murder by the student government of Stanford University. Ya-da-da-da-da. This is your nightly news host, Jimmy Breslin, and this is the way it is. Just saying, it is what it is. We're on the same page. We have taken it to the next level. The revolution is being televised. And now for your new nightly news, Andy Rooney type comment, but he's not here anymore. Just saying.
Blood from the body of a baby bombed to death in Baghdad. Blood by the pint running into the street as fast as a swift river has magic in its pure infant cells. Of course, you cannot scrub the street clean because the blood from the baby already has covered the street. And it's in the theirs. As they get off at Camp David, Bush's hand brushed against baby blood on the plane, as does his wife. At this hour in London, Blair arises in the middle of his long night and goes to the bathroom to try and wash his blood off. He couldn't do it before he went to bed. In Washington, Rumsfeld stares at the red splotches on both his hands, and Colin Powell calls out there must be something wrong with the soap because it does not get the blood off his hand. At Camp David, Bush notices blood on his right hand, and he holds his hands underwater and rubs them with a bar of soap, and then puts them under the water, and he takes them out and holds them out to dry with a towel. He glances at his hands and sees the blood of the dead baby is bright on his fingers. He mutters and washes the hands again. He will do it again. Again this year and next year and through all the years, because the blood remains forever on the hand. This has been Jimmy Breslin with your new nightly news.
Our next guest of the evening is Karen Kitkowski. Karen Kitkowski speaks to us each month from Mount Jackson, Virginia. She is a retired lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. She was at the Pentagon on the day of 9/11. She has run for Congress. She is a writer and activist and a farmer, I believe, in Mount Jackson. And she will be on the phone just shortly as soon as Chuck gets her dialed up.
I'm not available. Please leave a message and I'll call you back.
Well, Chuck, I'm sending you...
Let me try her other number, even though she said to call that one.
Okay. Karen, you can find a lot of Karen's writings on at lourockwell.com.
Hello. Please leave a message after the tone.
I guess we're not making it through this time, huh, Chuck?
I guess not.
Do you see the number on the chat there? Is that the number you tried the first time? Did you try? Is that the number you tried the first time?
That was the first. Yes.
Did you? Do you feel like trying that again to see if maybe?
Sure.
Maybe she.
Tell you what, why don't you talk a little bit and let me try calling her from my regular phone and see if I can get through and, you know, get her on here.
Talk about what? Okay, I'll just talk, I guess. I'm not good at this. That's why I go from a script. I'd like to mention the the book that Jim Fetzer and Chuck Gregory and Holly Domegard and we are putting together. It's called "And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either," and it's been what I would call highly successful. And that's not really bragging. It's just a fact of it. We've had so many that did not sell, and this one is selling. And it just celebrate that it's very cool that it is working out. And you can find "And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either" at Amazon.com. It's published through Create Space, Moonrock Books. Ole Domegard did a lot of the layout. He did the front and back cover. Jim Fetzer did most of the putting it together. And me, I'm along for the ride, basically. And it's a fun ride. We've been working on this book for over a year, and it's finally come to fruition. And I've said it before, but it's part of a series. The series is called Save the World, Resist the Empire. The first book was The Dynamic Duel. It's a biography of Kevin Barrett and Jim Fetzer. That was published by Chuck CWG Press. You can find The Dynamic Duel. The full title is The Dynamic Duel, White Rose Blooms in Wisconsin, Jim Fetzer, Kevin Barrett, and the American Resistance. You find that on Amazon. And there's just if you know who Kevin Barrett and Jim Fetzer are, you know that there's a lot to them, there's a lot of depth there. And it's we've got a lot of their personal history, also a lot of their opinions and their facts about all the different false flags of American history that are happening. And, to my way of thinking, I just think it's the place to go to find out what is really happening in the world is Fetzer and Barrett. Also, James Tracy, a Memory Hole blog, and also Veterans Today. But, I don't know, how do I put it? I just think that is, these people are the ones to go to find out what's really happening. And that's why we put the book together. And the rest of this series, there's this book, The Moon Book, which also talks about the Holocaust, Paul McCartney, the fake doubles of Osama bin Laden. And the next book will be Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, and that's already in the process. Well, we've actually been talking about that for over a year as well. And it'll be about Sandy Hook. It'll be also about the Boston bombing, that nobody died there. It's a hoax. For what reason? Well, I don't know. I think it's just a strike. It's an Operation Gladio type event to keep us afraid and to make us reach out in the direction of the police. And I think that's why they're doing it. It's kind of amazing that people would devote their lives. I mean, talking about people in the FBI, CIA, NSA, why they would devote their lives to something so hideous as all these lies and whatever. Why can't you devote your life to something good? You know, America, there's so much good here, but why do you want to spend your whole life trying to ruin it? I don't get it. And the last book, and hopefully we'll get it out in the fall, and the title is yet to be decided, but it'll be about 9/11 and fairly new discoveries about what may have brought those towers down, and also about the other aspects of that day. You know, when you think about it, where did Shanks go, for one thing? And in my way of thinking, if you show that one of these things is wrong, you show them all. So, the weakest link might be Shanksville. In my mind, they say a plane went in that little hole. Yeah, right. It sure did. There's no luggage. There's no blood, no body parts, no plane parts. But it's right down there in that hole. Believe us, So that's a lie. And just competing with so many other lies. And the reason for this series is, there are just so many lies, and there's just a catalog of false flag events that we felt needed to be put together in book form and to have available, and to try to, history is important, because if we have false history, which we do now, we're going to have a false future, I believe, okay, based on lies, and we're not heading into anything true. We're just going from bad to bad. And we need to know even if it's painful, we need to know what happened in the past. You need to know who killed Paul Wellstone. Was it Dick Cheney? He was going to stop the Iraq War. He was a little flawed. He wasn't as in my mind, as strong and radical and liberal as I would have liked him to be, but he was strong enough. And he was a thorn in their side. And
Mike, I think history is written by the winners. And lately, the winners have definitely not been on the side, on our side, not been on the side of the people.
Yeah, I agree, Chuck.
I tried a couple more times to reach Karen and send her an email. I don't know what happened. I guess,
okay.
Must have interfered with her being available tonight. So hopefully we'll catch her next month. That's a couple of months in a row we haven't been able to get her on the show, and we miss her because
she has
some good stuff to say.
Yeah, she's a great guest, and I think it just really what I think happens sometimes is it's just so nice weather, and at least here in Minnesota you don't get that often, and you want to go out and enjoy it, and you don't. I don't know. That might happen, not intentionally, but it just, you know, you want to go do something.
So what do we have coming up next half hour, Mike?
In the next half hour, we have Mike Lannis, and Mike Lannis is always a great guest. He is executive editor of Howling Dog Press. He is in Denver. He is a poet. He is the, along with Chuck Gregory, he is one of the true book people in the country, the real somebody who will publish something and put the work into it and produce something great just because it's the right thing to do. And Mike Lannis says, if you would go to the Howling Dog Press website or look for anything that he's done, it's just real quality work. Mike put together one of my books a long time ago called Looking for Bigfoot. And it was a pleasure to work with him. And he's just one of the best. He's fighting the good fight, putting out quality work, and just keeping at it year after year after year. And it's very cool. We look forward to talking to him.
Coming soon to your county fair, the traveling display, the United States of America Hall of Shame. These are your lone nuts, the wackos, the criminals, the terrorists, the long-haired weirdos in the greasy raincoats in the subway at midnight. America, where we produce monsters who appear as anyone, and yet through their actions and inactions kill the prophets, keep the poor in the gutter, and still continue to live out their lives in peace in America, and long later die on television with full honors, and still we say nothing about their crimes, but go home after the parade shaking our heads, at least, finally, rid of them. Please come out to your local county fair to see the traveling display, photos, memorabilia of the Bush administration, Ronald Reagan, the Warren Commission, the 9/11 Commission, Paul Tibbetts, Harry Truman, George Bush Sr., Bill Clinton, Janet Reno, Lon Horiuchi, the FBI sniper who shot and killed Vicki Weaver while she was holding her 10-month-old child behind the door of the family home at Ruby Ridge. You can also see historical Hall of Shame displays of the medical examiner at Sandy Hook and a real-life display of the desk of reporter Bob Woodward, who supposedly uncovered Watergate, but it was actually a CIA agent who did not let it get out that the break-in was really all about the JFK murder. Come on out to your county fair. It's pretty much all there. Every director of the Bureau of Prisons, every director of the INS, the IRS, and the FBI. Step right up, throw a tomato, hit Clinton in the nose, and win a stuffed animal for your sweetie pie. Fulfill that recurring dream you have of punching George W. Bush smack in the face. These are your lone nuts, the wackos, the criminals, the terrorists, the long-haired weirdos in the greasy raincoats in the subway at midnight. America, where we produce monsters who appear as anyone and yet through their actions and inactions kill the prophets, keep the poor in the gutter, and still continue to live out their lives in peace in America. And long later die on television with full honors, and still we say nothing about their crimes, but go home after the parade, shaking our heads at last, finally, rid of them.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachuk with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard. From Citizens for Legitimate Government, Saudi-led strikes on Yemen convoy killed 31 civilians. Saudi-led airstrikes hit a convoy of civilians fleeing violence in southern Yemen on Wednesday, killing at least 31 people, medical officials said, making it among the deadliest single attacks since the air campaign against Shia rebels and their allies began nearly 3 months ago.
Islamic State claimed Yemen bombings kill at least 4 people. A series of Islamic State claimed bombings in Yemen's rebel-controlled capital killed at least 4 people and wounded 60 Wednesday night amid the country's raging war.
Melee erupts at Yemen peace talks, underscoring rifts. A fistfight erupted on the sidelines of the peace talks in Geneva between supporters of different warring factions in Yemen, underlining the divisions that have thwarted United Nations efforts to broker a truce in the near 3-month conflict.
15 killed in mortar attacks, airstrike in Iraq's Anbar. A total of 15 people were killed and 36 others were wounded in mortar attacks and an airstrike targeting a position of the Islamic State, IS, militants in the volatile province of Anbar.
Rebel fire kills 8 as insurgents push into Aleppo. Rebel fire killed 8 people in Syria's second city, Aleppo, the latest in a spate of civilian deaths in government-held districts.
2 dead and 6 wounded in South Lebanon refugee camp clash. 2 men were killed and at least 11 people were wounded when a personal dispute escalated into violent clashes between 2 militias in the South Lebanon refugee camp of Ain al-Hiway.
Footage allegedly shows IDF sniper killing Palestinian without cause. A video posted online purports to show an Israeli sniper shooting dead an unarmed Palestinian in the occupied West Bank village of Siwad. The soldier is shown aiming at the faraway figure, then a shot rings out and the person collapses.
UN, 129 Sudan children killed in a month. The United Nations agency says at least 129 children were killed during government offensive against rebel forces in South Sudan last month.
Boko Haram kills at least 30 in attacks on Niger villages, sources say. Boko Haram militants attacked 2 villages in southern Niger's Diffa region overnight, killing at least 30 civilians, 2 security sources said.
4 killed as Somalia foils suicide attack. Security forces prevented a suicide attack against a political conference in central Somalia, killing 3 gunmen and the driver of a car packed with explosives, police said.
11 police, army dead in Taliban attack, Afghan officials say. The officials said today that 4 soldiers and 7 police officers were killed with the insurgents overran Musa Qala, which has shifted between government and Taliban control for years. Yeah, that's all, folks. That's the news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck, and so it goes. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. It is what it is. At the end of the day, have a good day, and remember, that you can start the revolution today. by making direct eye contact with any policeman. Our next guest of the evening is Michael Annis. Michael Annis speaks to us each fourth week of each month from Denver. Mike is the executive editor of Howling Dog Press. He is also a poet, a writer, and he is one of the great book publishers in America. And Chuck is getting Michael on the line right about now.
Hello.
Well, hello, Michael. It's Chuck and Mike in the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Well, hi, Chuck and Mike. Thanks for having your resident smart aleck back. I've got a continuation of Brave New World Order, Part 10, which is subtitled, "And the Bleat Goes On." Start with a quote. "If God did not exist, it would be necessary to invent him." Voltaire. "And the Bleat Goes On." In the chronological succession of each historical moment, religious thinking, the precepts of theological bullying, and the tyranny of a few men's self-proclaimed direct connection to the divine and eternal commandeered human livestock, the overlord's sheep, to atone for the sins of the human race by such acts of unswervingly loyal penitence as thrashing themselves to a bloody pulp, figuratively and literally, thus beating out the impiety from their midst, the midst of their own defiant inner beings, and executing all those who hesitated from public confession, often in private chambers, of being owned and indentured by their religious masters by stoning, drowning, burning, poisoning, quartering, hanging, crucifying, skinning, decapitating, disemboweling, simple bloodletting, tar and feathering, and so forth. All the while gentling themselves to their flocks, they folded their hands, raised their gazes heavenward, and allowed the lone tear to escape publicly out of the mascarad eye, down the rouged cheek and off the powdered chin, in pity for those who may have drawn the scourge of the wrath of God upon their faces and upon the face of the earth, putting all others at risk for further sacred and holy chastenings, which would prove far superior and far more severe than any invention of humiliation and degradation by their fellow man. Oh, where was the equanimity of the former tribal system, the ancestors in the clouds pondered? To where had equality been banished? Or, if not this particular grumbling, a miscreant might submit the notion, in quotes, "Is not the greater philosophical consideration that if we did not exist, then would it not be necessary to invent us, the human race," end quotes. Arrogant? Perhaps. However, one might take the position that if God truly existed apart from and beyond all the belief systems, then she-he had more in mind than mere entertainment when she-he set the clay upon the wheel. True or false? Or might that be relegated to a sophist word game? Yet, spotlight the sin of all political, social, and sexual deviants, such as, for the sake of example, homosexuals who only wanted to have illicit relations with young boys whom they might overpower secretly in closets, behind barns, or in basements. Was there not a price to pay for acts against the moral code of law? To have them set a fire in holy brimstone, to send a plague to weed them out, to eliminate selected decadent and discordant populations. But, oh, say it isn't so. God's wrath turning indiscriminate, falling out of control, confirmed rogue by the afflictions of the very same plagues upon newborn babies, non-homosexual drug users, spouses of homosexuals and drug users, children of the same, the crippled, blind, and elderly, and other less easily categorized, more nebulous potential targets of divine cleansings. They were meant as cleansings, were they not? One historical divine coup de grace was the Black Death, where, according to several debauched accounts, much the same intention was made manifest, but it accomplished divine good as a byproduct of spiritual cleansing, managing to postpone the inevitable overpopulation of the earth, for the human race had been commanded to go forth to the ends of the earth and multiply, which they did, like bacteria in a dead cow. To affirm through example of the necessity of this mission, in the year 1348, hysteria-filled Christians concluded that the Black Death was caused by Jews using the devil's alchemic bile to poison their wells. Ergo, in one day, August 24, 1349, 6,000 Jews were slaughtered by inflamed, psalms-shrieking penitents in Mainz, Germany, who, as in the good old days of old, drove out before them any humans in league with demons, thus incurring the favor of their God that he might lift his horrible judgment from the face of the land and the soul of the brethren. And the fleas rejoiced. Religious mobs with pitchforks and sickles thrust and slashed their way through 10,000 more demon-infested Jews in Bavaria, flagellant armies roaming the fields and streets in the appeasement of God's merciful cleansing, got with the program and whipped themselves into bloody frenzies to expiate their sins. And those who paused and questioned and knew no and did not follow suit were blessed by fatal scourgings from their neighbors and kin. What ensued was the storming of Jewish and Muslim sectors in gruesome massacres, seeking out culprits who, by their illicit beliefs in their illicit sects, brought about the greater indiscrimination of God's planned massacre through disease of all those who had happened to be bitten by the devil himself. But are they not one and the same? And the fleas rejoiced. Despite all their acts of purification, atonement, repentance, and murder, unbeknownst to them, a tiny bacillus with the face of Satan was wiping out half the population of Europe under the joint auspices of church, state, king, pope, and the brotherhood of man. In other words, God Almighty himself, commander of the oligarchic prosecutors, and the fleas rejoiced. All the while, their ministers, the mouthpieces for God, never resolved the truly great religious arguments, such as, to reiterate, a loving God allowing half of the earth's population, men, women, and children, mostly workers, to perish by plague or to exist day by day in the clutches of poverty, or to die of starvation while first living in starvation, or to be swept into the sea, or buried alive, or incinerated by great natural disasters, or to be murdered at the hands of their own species in such forms as a great supervisor-made chemical cloud annihilating entire sections of a nation in a silent, toxic storm, or inquisitions, death camps, or... Why 6 million plus were herded together to perish in a short, intense war of genocide in civilized, industrialized, fetally atomic age Central Europe that danced to jazz and wept at the beauty of the arts as poets sang, I saw the best minds of my generation heatedly debating the efficiency of various techniques of extermination. Why 11 million were murdered in the largest landmass on earth as the result of the suspicions and lust for total power by one supervisor. Why 15 to 16 million, who keeps track anyway, were exterminated in the Congo under the pretense and authority of the divine right of kings. Why all these in a time span shorter than a single century, for all fell short of the glory of God. All fell short of eternity, for all were brought to vapor and dust under one modus of religion or another, for the human knew no reservations for what or how he worshipped, and the worship of profit, power, and glory always lingered in the deep holy recesses of his soul. And the fleas rejoiced, and the sheep bleat. The overlords designed religions that would keep the workers dumb, poor, terrified, in reverential awe of everything they did not possess, enslaved to all they did possess, acquiescent and subservient to all the overlords chose to do. These gods they invented reputedly were troubled and burdened. If your house burned down, your children slowly and painfully roasted or froze to death, or your lovers died in excruciating assassination by plague or at the hands of sadistic monsters, whether world-class or small-time, popes, dictators, emperors, banksters, gangsters, cranksters, and common everyday petty psychopathic predators. That was an interesting but short-sighted and fallacious notion. It was damned evident that these gods placed a high priority on whether one spoke reverently and superstitiously to and about them, and whether one's eye wandered to other spiritual resources for answers to one's problems, lest they strike one and one's loved ones deaf, dumb, blind, or dead. But the rest was a faithful crapshoot. Jealous gods, they, one and all, and human beings at the mercy of their mercy, remain conscripted and ultimately scorned. They spoke of the prophets, the poets and philosophers. They lamented Wagner, Dostoevsky, Heidegger, Nietzsche, or Voltaire. And in their absence, and the absence of absolute truth, human contrived allegories that looked back at the past through his thirsting for some perfection in the future. And human's allegories might unravel like this. Upside down. Was the world upside down? Existence was blankly staring at them, and they appeared downside up. Oh, blankety, blankety, blank, existence thought, existence muttered. But being upside down, it was difficult to tell from just where the sound came. To make the world right side up, in other words, upside up, they threw the carcass of existence upside down in a wood-wheeled cart, and struggled with her obstinacy back to the barracks, careful not to overturn her, that she might end up downside up. It was ironic. If only she had been kept upside up and downside down, then she might not have ever died and ended up like this. But was that not the fate of existence from the very beginning? To perish once and for all with the signature of sin stamped in large black festering boils in her groin and armpits. There was an order to everything, and as they carted her off, everything about existence now in order, they refreshed their consciences, knowing they were just following orders. And the fleas rejoice, and the bleat goes on, and the bleat goes on, and the bleat goes on, and the bleat goes on.
Well, that was quite something.
Well, thanks, Chuck. I brought it in under our time constraint of 12 minutes, and I appreciate you giving me that little bit of extra time.
We did. In fact, we have 2 or 3 minutes to spare, so we can... we can chat a bit.
Okay, cool.
Don't we hear the music taking us out?
Well, what would you like to chat about, my friend?
Well, what's going on with you on the magazine front these days?
Well, the magazine front. Well, I think that you and Mike both just received a copy of the latest Churn, which was published last spring. And in fact, it did contain the first part, first and second parts, actually, of what I read on the air on the New American Dream of Brave New World Order. What I'm working on right now and what I am really, really involved, focused on, so to speak, is the development of a new piece of hardware that I call SIEGE, S-I-E-G-E, exclamation point. It's also an arts and literary magazine, and I should have the first issue out possibly in September. I'm going to be featuring numerous writers, poets, a lot more politics, a lot more of the edgy sort of artwork. Churn's a fine magazine, a beautiful magazine. You know, commendations to, of course, Jeff Mongi, the publisher, and to all who brought Churn into being from days of old. But I think it's time that I brought more politics, and it's hard for me to work with, for, whatever, someone anyway, because I find that it's just that I like to bring in things that are so counterculturally topical that people get nervous, you know? So I find that if I'm going to do it, I need to do it myself. And I've had a history of doing that through Howling Dog Press, of course. trying to bring in as much of the edgy, politically oriented, socially unnerving type of work that I possibly can. So that's exactly what's going on right now.
Well, okay. Did you say this new thing is a piece of hardware?
Well, I call it a piece of hardware because it's not going to be an electronic publication that you go online and get online. It's actually going to be a printed on paper, bound, and so forth.
Okay.
So that's what I meant by hardware.
Okay.
But I mean, of course, you know, using the pun and the irony of the pun of the word siege, you know, and you think of hardware that might be involved in certain types of warfare, cannons, bazookas, guns, knives, whatever. There is a siege that's going on in the arts and literature. So, you know, it was just kind of an offhanded pun.
Well, I liked that.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Back on.
And now for another episode of The American Stuck in Traffic. The American Stuck in Traffic is stuck in traffic on Interstate 35, headed south to Minneapolis from a weekend at the cabin near Two Harbors on a Sunday afternoon. It's bumper to bumper with boats and bicycles on bungee cords. The kids and the wife are asleep in the back of the black SUV. His phone is dead because he left his charger at home. All he has are 9 miles of red brake lights flickering on and off, on and off. The freckled kid in front of him flipping him the bird through the back window of a giant home on wheels, and his own thoughts. He has no choice but to think. He tries to stop it. Tries to think of playing baseball in ninth grade and making that diving catch with Mary Lou watching. But it's no use. His mind drifts towards thinking. Drifting. Oh, crap. Here it comes. The American stuck in traffic just lets it come like a big poop in the weeds in the woods.
Here in the United States, we're often brought up and told we don't have propaganda, that we have a hard-charging investigative press. We have this educated, skeptical, even cynical citizenry, and that if there were powerful interests trying to manage or manipulate public opinion, they would be exposed. The reality actually is just the opposite. Academics who spent their lifetimes looking at how propaganda works finds that it's actually in Western democracies and open societies where you need the most sophisticated sorts of propaganda. And since World War I, thanks to people like Ivy Lee and Eddie Bernays, propaganda has become a business, this business of public relations. Throngs of Iraqis spontaneously attack a statue of Saddam Hussein in the face obscured with Old Glory. Later, the stars and stripes are replaced with red, white, and black, symbolizing the transference of power from the liberators to the liberated. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld describes the scenes as breathtaking. To the British Army, they're historic. BBC Radio calls them amazing, and they were, because the entire event was staged. Years after the operation, a U.S. Army report admitted that the toppling of the Saddam statue had been engineered by a psychological operations group. The document states, our TPT, or Tactical PSYOP team, saw the statue as a target of opportunity. A week earlier, another psychological operation laid the groundwork for what followed. The script was for a female Rambo turned damsel in distress to be rescued by U.S. Armed Forces. In the situation that we're talking here, with Private Lynch, as you know, on about the 23rd of March, her 507th maintenance company was ambushed. A number of the members of that maintenance company were killed, a number were captured, and a number were unaccounted for, she being one of them. They waited 24 hours to get the cameras there to set up the whole thing to make this big rescue, and the SWAT team goes in to save her, and then she becomes an instant celebrity overnight. That story happened on the same day that the tanks were rolling into Baghdad. That's the same day that we shelled the Palestine Hotel where the independent journalists were. The same day we blew up Al Jazeera's television station and killed one of their journalists. All we're getting on the front pages of the papers and in the news is the rescue of Jessica Lynch. So that was a PR substitute story. Toppling the Saddam statue, they got Chalabi's group. The Rendon group had actually formed them. The CIA paid the Rendon group to form the Iraqi Congress as a counter group to Saddam Hussein, and they were based here in the U.S. Then they flew them over there and they shipped them into Iraq. They were the ones that were standing around the statue as a tank was used to pull it over. The Rendon group had been around. He worked for George W.'s father, and he worked for Clinton, too. His firm, he used to be a public relations press guy for Carter, and he created a PR firm that specialized in war. The head of the Rendon group, John Rendon, denies that he is a national security strategist or a military tactician. Rather, he states, I am a politician and a person who uses communication to meet public policy or corporate policy objectives. In fact, I am an information warrior and a perception manager. Following the first Gulf War, Rendon was paid $23 million by the CIA to create anti-Saddam propaganda. Following 9/11, he was charged with public relations for the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. Rendon is far from alone. Public relations has mushroomed into a $200 billion a year industry, with PR flacks in the U.S. now outnumbering journalists. Propaganda has become the primary means by which the wealthy communicate with the rest of society. Whether selling a product, a political candidate, a law, or a war, seldom do the powerful deliver messages to the public before consulting their colleagues in the public relations industry. You see a news show, you watch 60 Minutes or a Fox program, or whatever it is. You tend to give more credibility to what you're told is journalism. If an advertisement comes on, hopefully you tend to be more skeptical of that, because obviously somebody put an awful lot of money into crafting this slick TV ad and airing it. But what you probably never suspect is that the news story you just watched was also crafted by a company, given to the TV station or network with the understanding that they would put their own logos on it and identify it as real journalism and air it.
The American stuck in traffic saw the motorhome ahead of him pulling away. He flipped a little kid the bird and hoped the little kid would grow up an orphan, because his face was just one giant freckle, and his parents traded him for a better kid, one that would be a St. Thomas Academy hockey star, make him proud and famous at church. And one day he would see the little freckled kid on Hennepin Avenue asleep in the gutter at 2 p.m. and he would smile. The red brake lights of the giant motorhome flashed. The American stuck in traffic coasted up right behind the giant motorhome. He looked up at the freckled butt smooshed into the back window. He tried to think of apple pie at Applebee's, the St. Paul summer nights with Garrison Keillor on the radio, something else in winter, but it was no use. Well, it's been another long week in Newtown, my hometown, at the end of the empire. It's time for the publication of the new sophomore history textbook. The bread and butter of 3B1K Publishing House, managed by Nicostatus Greenberg in Newtown. Seems nobody's paying much attention to history these days. What's he to do? Well, he's running all over the grounds to talk to people to figure things out, for one thing. Last week, he visited his daughters, the one who's a public school teacher in history. And then he headed across the street jaywalking to get to the little white house where another daughter homeschools her kids. Nicostatus is running all over heck and high water trying to figure out what to do. Why? Because he thinks, he believes, he assumes it is his decision to make. Who's going to Newtown? I am. Well, who's going with you? Nobody. Take Harley with you. And hurry. There isn't much time. Fulton Crampton exited the quiet, perfect tile, marble, and classical music, Bouton, Fifflin, Starcourt. Mason Yovanovich Fafanovich Banana Fana Mamanovich offices. As he pushed the glass door under the hard, cracked squawk of Broadway, with tall, straight back and long, bleached white fingers barely gripping the thin briefcase at his knees, he moseyed to the curb, waited for 1003 for the yellow cab, and got in. At 30,000 feet, Fulton Crampton eased his chair back, accepted his whiskey with cracked ice, put on his black eye mask patch, plugged in his earphones, and remembered he had left Harlan Lombardi. The red pickup turned into BBBK Drive, hitting the curb with one tire, tossing around the inhabitants, four large women stuffed like bread loaves into the front and Fulton Crampton in the back. Sitting straight, his briefcase in his lap, his legs dangling out the back, Fulton Crampton climbed down, waved to the women with their hands out the windows and stopped to take a look around. The statue elbowing out the marquee with the old subtitle, The Tower, the mill, the glassed office buildings, golf course, the hint of the river, the long green hedge. That might be new, he thought. He did one deep knee bend. Fulton Crampton tried to remember how long it had been since he'd been here. He usually made use of the telephonic system. Maybe he'd never been here. He walked into the nearest building marked Main Office in subtle Times New Roman on the glass door. Seeing no one at the desks or cubicles, he sat in a chair with his back to the window, his briefcase in his lap. At almost the same time, Harlan Lombardi settled into a middle seat, preparing for takeoff. Actually, he squeezed. He was not a small man. He closed his eyes. Fulton Crampton wondered how long it would take Nick Estatus Greenberg to appear in his own office, or anyone in the history book publishing business, for that matter. He checked his watch and imagined Harley Lombardi squeezing his fists and eyes and toes to get the plane into the air. This was all part of the annual book release dance. Fulton Crampton would make his call to Nick, saying it was time to sell, that he should retire. Go fishing, Fulton would say. Relax. You're not going to live forever, unless you know something we don't know. The same thing every year. Every year, Nick would hang up without talking, but this year was different. For what reason, Fulton Crampton did not know, just that his boss had sent him in person, told him to take Harley Lombardi with him and come back with BBBK in hand, which would give the big New York company almost total control of the sophomore history textbook market, which would put Fulton Crampton's Tuesday afternoon Manhattan Club in control of what Americans would think, understand, and believe for years to come. Not that the textbooks of Nick Estatus Greenberg were radical or socialist or communist. They had all the right subtitles, covers, study guides, the common chapter, but sources had given indications that Nick Estatus Greenberg had been walking around town listening and asking, and walking around his company listening and asking, and that was never a good idea. Harlan Lombardi accepted the peanuts and a Diet Pepsi he had coming, setting an elbow in a man's nose to get them. He did not look as he passed Pennsylvania, Illinois, Indiana. Fulton Crampton looked at his watch. He consumed a deep breath, faced forward, straightened his back, and without looking, itched his ankle with the edge of his shiny black shoe. He raised his head, his chin, as Daisy appeared at a receptionist desk on the other side of the room. He stood to see over cubicle tops. She waved and smiled and trotted the other way, her hair bouncing on alert like the tail of a doe. Bolton Crampton sat. He pulled the peanut pouch from his jacket pocket, tipped his head, poured the contents into his mouth, keeping his eyes open, darting, looking for Nick Green. He folded the plastic pouch and placed it onto the metal ashtray next to him. He tried not to stare as the folded bag slowly uncurled, as if alive. He heard the muffler of the red pickup and the crack of four heads on the cab roof as the tire hit the curb. Harlan quick grabbed a pencil stub from his pocket and his peanut bag to write the number below the magnetic sign on the doors that said Airport Shuttle, in case he needed to use their excellent services again. Bolton Crampton nodded as Harlan Lombardi sat in the chair next to him, moved his own chair to avoid Harlan's arms. "You were supposed to get me," said Harlan. Bolton Crampton looked at Harlan. "And that's the news from Newtown. For all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average. The new American dream means never having to say some question or idea is not valid. We're allowed to ask any questions that we have. There are no wrong questions. There's no hidden black military budget. There are no UFO files Americans cannot see. No JFK documents that will not be opened during our lifetime. No destroyed RFK murder photos by the LA police. No evidence from Ground Zero taken away before we can even look at it. We're not the USSR of the 1960s. This is supposed to be America. That is our dream, to become America, the new America, the real hope of the world. We have a dream of bringing the United States politicians, journalists, and generals who brought about this long 12-year war and debacle to trial. Put them on TV just like OJ every afternoon so every American can watch, just like the McCarthy hearings and the JFK funeral procession. What we need is a new American dream, not of new homes and toasters and microwaves, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were. Right now we live on lies. We subsist on lies, but it's not really living. 9/11 was an inside job. Bush, Cheney, Rice, Powell, Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, Obama, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, they all know it. What we need in America is a truth commission like they had in South Africa to heal their broken country. We need to put certain people on the stand, and we need to be allowed to ask questions. Our country is surely broken as well. The troops are not protecting us. That's someone's spin on the day's news, somebody's advertising slogan, someone else's sermon. The troops serve the empire. They are not heroes. They kill and plunder for the empire. American bases overseas serve nobody but the empire. The heroes in our country are the protesters, the ones who go face to face with the empire, those in the plowshares movement, for one example. You have to know that Barack Obama knows the whole truth about 9/11 attacks. He's complicit. He's lied. He's continued the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan based on a lie, and he knows he's lying. He lied right to our faces on national television when he said that Osama bin Laden had been killed and buried at sea. Osama bin Laden was buried at sea, and Jessica Lynch was rescued heroically. The USA does not torture. Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. George Bush won the 2000 election. See, there is a plane there in that hole in Shanksville. Went all the way into that hole. And no, there's no blood, no bodies, no luggage scatter or plane parts. And Osama bin Laden was buried at sea. Remember the anthrax letters which said, "Are you afraid?" Those were not written with a rock and chisel like Fred Flintstone from the recesses of some cave in Afghanistan. Those letters came from persons within our own government, like a horror movie. And the killer is in the same house with us. These killers are right here with us. And they want us to be afraid. We cannot be afraid. We're now very near to the end of another episode of the New American Dream radio show. I'd like to remind you all that we're streaming live here from 6 to 8 p.m. every Thursday on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's a listener-supported network. They have a lot of great shows, and we hope that you'll find your way over to freedomslips.com, buy one of their promotional items, or give them a donation to keep all these great shows on the air, ours included. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Julius Awafong from Cameroon and Michael Annis from Denver. We're sorry we missed Karen Kikowski, but we'll get her next month. And I'd especially like to thank each and every one of you listeners for joining us. We hope you'll join us again next week. We hope you'll listen to our archives. And you can find those archives at newdream.us. You can also subscribe to the podcast feed there at newdream.us, and you can listen to our shows as we put them up there. Listen right on your iPad or your iPhone or whatever you use to listen to podcasts. That's a great way to do it. Once again, we thank you. And I thank you, Mike, and good night.
Good night, Chuck. And I want to take a little bit more time to plug my recent book, not mine, but me and several others. It's called "And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either." It talks about moon landings. It talks about the Holocaust. It talks about Paul McCartney, Saddam Hussein, double Osama bin Laden, double. You can get the book at Amazon.com. It's called "And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either." It's part of a series. The series is entitled "Save the World, Resist the Empire," and it's by Moon Rock Books. The next book in the series, the first book in the series, was "The Dynamic Duo: The Biography of Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett." Now there's this book. Now the next book will be "Nobody Died at Sandy Hook." It will also cover Boston bombing. And the final book in the series in the fall will cover the 9/11 attacks with a different twist on how the towers came down. To get the archives of our show from February 2011, go to theshow.newamericandream.info. And as always, we apologize for our mistakes and plan to make fewer mistakes next week. To contact the show, either Chuck or me or any of our guests, write to me at nwestiowa@gmail.com, nwestiowa@gmail.com. And as always, we wish to acknowledge the work of South Dakota stone artisan Borglum Borglumson as he works to make over Mount Rushmore, put the real face of American history up there in stone. Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, Mark David Chapman, and James Earl Ray. Follow the ongoing project at loserock.com, rollingstones.com, and Jack Ruby, rubyridge.com.
To help support the show, please purchase one of our Tom Jefferson Rolling in His Grave Handy Campfire Rotisseries for the hobo in your family, or get one of our family-size Obamaville Tom Jefferson Rotisseries for the busy family on the move from town to town, woods to woods, made in Korea. And so good night to my friends Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley. And good night, Stephen Sala. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Muhammad Atta. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.